That Nixon might have been involved in the heroin coup for his own personal gain is lent credence by the following quote from Dan Mulday's respected book, The Hoffa Wars, Charter Books, 1978. A former Nixon aide, not privy to the Hague investigation, says that one of his associates in the White House mentioned to him sometime during the impeachment summer, unquote, that someone high up, maybe White House Chief of Staff General Alexander Haig, was interested in Nixon's possible organized crime involvements, unquote. That conversation involved a massive payoff, unquote, from those in Army Service Club scandals in Vietnam during 1969 or 70. The aide says that the Service Club ripoffs, quote, involved the mafia and millions of dollars, and that the main force of focus of the interest by someone high up in the White House was on whether the top mafia guy who ran, quote, all these things in Southeast Asia, unquote, had made payoffs to Nixon. The crime figure, he says, was the one who was apparently known as the so-called mastermind or architect of the Southeast Asian drug trade, who was very powerful and very well known as a mob leader. According to government narcotics experts, the central figure in the Indochina Golden Triangle narcotics traffic was Santos Traficante, unquote. In my opinion, the central manipulator in the whole narcotics scheme was the CIA, or rather a faction within it. It is erroneous to treat the agency as a monolith. Various lobby groups have their own agents in the company, generating internal power struggles that reflect political polarizations external to the CIA. There are, doubtless, CIA factions wholeheartedly in favor of ending America's policeman and oppressor roles, and in favor of social democratic rather than right-wing regimes. Equally certain is the fact that one should take the agency's new, outwardly benign face with a grain of salt. Within the agency, there remain powerful groups promoting continued support of old friends in Latin America and Southeast Asia. The China-Cuba lobby has traditionally been one of the most influential within the CIA, and there is little reason to believe that the situation has seriously changed. Finally, the agency has laid low of late, as the Carter administration has lobbied for a relaxation of constraints placed upon it by Congress in the wake of the 70s exposés of CIA horror stories. In addition to, or rather behind, the CIA's new official policy, there is also an unofficial one. It manifests itself in such matters as the manipulation of the DEA to perform what previously had been CIA dirty work, and in the toleration, if not encouragement, of a large, apparently independent army of Cuban exile terrorists available for action in Latin America at the request of the presiding dictators. The evidence suggests that the forces behind the unofficial policy were able to place many of their loyal CIA agents in the DEA and in such private intelligence agency covers as Intertel and Wackenhut, where they continue their tasks while letting the agency wash its hands. Intelligence is still gathered by the CIA, but some of the dirtiest operations are now performed by former, unquote, agents.
We cannot, of course, discount the possibility that the unofficial policy is in fact executed by former agents who had either been purged from the agency or left in protest against its more moderate line. However, that implies that a renegade CIA faction now runs an independent secret service, aided by lobby interests. In other words, not Intertel, but an even more powerful, quote, third force. If that is so, I could come up with only one lobby group with the relevant motives as well as the power to back them. The World Anti-Communist League, otherwise known as WACL. WACL. WACL can mobilize CIA agents closely associated with the China-Cuba-Chile lobby, especially the large contingent of former agents of the Galen-Vlasov organization, in parentheses, the intelligence agency run by Hitler's master spy Reinhard Galen, which became the BND, the West German equivalent of the CIA. E. Howard Hunt was clearly the China-Cuban-Latin American lobby's man. That he is also tied to WACL is suggested by the fact that William F. Buckley, Hunt's close friend for 20 years and the godfather of his children, was one of WACL's top U.S. supporters. Also connected to the same lobby groups are Lucien Conin and the State Department's former intelligence chief, Ray S. Klein, who continues to be a frequent guest at the Taiwan World Anti-Communist League stronghold. Hunt and Conin were the vital forces behind the White House's great heroin coup. Hunt secured the Cuban exiles their necessary footing and he got his friends Bernard Barker and Manuel Artime to set up, quote, hit teams to kidnap and murder Latin American narcotics traffickers. According to Frank Sturgis, those traffickers included members of Auguste Ricord and Christian David's Grupo Francais. Hunt persuaded Agil Crow to bring CIA agents into the White House narcotics apparatus. He told Crow that he knew, quote, key CIA officers who could be temporarily detached from the agency and employed by the new liaison group, unquote. It was Hunt who recommended Lucien Conin to head the group. Finally, it was intelligence reports from the CIA and Conin's group which made White House narcotics actions focus almost exclusively on the Corsicans. Conin's close friend, Mitch Werbel III, told journalist Jim Hogan he, quote, found it difficult to believe that a lifelong spy of Conin's stature could ever really leave the CIA. Accustomed to the use of other government agencies as CIA covers, Werbel quite naturally held open the possibility that Conin's DEA job was no more than an exercise in sheep-dipping the backgrounds and identities of the Dirty Dozen, all of whom were CIA veterans. Unquote. The desire to help its old friends in Southeast Asia and Latin America was not the CIA's only motive for promoting the heroin coup. The Gaullists in France, including their loyal adherents in intelligence agency SDECE and their dirty tricksters in SAC, were, in the de Gaulle era, the CIA's arch-enemies, as well as rivals for control of the world heroin trade. One can well imagine the CIA joining forces with Georges Pompidou and other pro-U.S. forces in France in crushing the old Gaullist intelligence network. In 1973, with the Corsicans finally pushed out of the picture, the White House reorganized the narcotics effort to form the DEA. Almost immediately, heroin began flowing to the U.S. from new sources of supply. Journalist Ron Rosenbaum cites the following statement by a U.S. customs official. Quote, BNDD and customs are finally getting somewhere. They break up the French connection. They're getting big conspiracy cases. Suddenly they, the White House, step in and there's this big shake-up, and by the time people get back to work, the Mexican connection is set up, protected, and doing big business. What's that say to you? Unquote. He might have added that the Southeast Asian connection was also protected and doing big business. The emergence of the DEA was the next-to-last phase of the heroin coup. Hunt and Conin's CIA agents moved into DEA intelligence in operation, Conin locating 12 Latino CIA agents in his special operations group alone. The Dirty Dozen was officially created to combat Cuban and Latin American narcotics smugglers, allegedly following the assassination approach conceived in the darkest corners of the White House.
It must have been a gag. Conin's forces were apparently directed, for the most part, against small-time independents who had competed with the big-time traffickers in on the heroin coup. The biggest Cuban network, Santo Traficantes, went untouched. Miami's 1974-75 murder wave in Little Havana might even have been connected to the activities of Conin's Cubans. The victims had opposed Orlando Bosch's drive for solidarity in terrorism, a drive which, as suggested by writer Hogan, might well have enjoyed the support of Traficante and Robert Vesco. Of the latter two, certainly the first and quite possibly the second as well were central figures in the heroin coup. That brings us to the last, the political phase of the heroin coup, which began with the DEA's 1974 takeover of the CIA's Latin American torture and repression apparatus, and ended with the 1976 creation of CORU, Bosch's terrorist army. Ended is, however, the incorrect word, since the brutalities financed by the heroin coup continue. The DEA, or that part of it penetrated by the CIA, protects the major narcotics dealers. The latter, in turn, support, financially and through gun running, anti-communist paramilitary groups which work hand-in-hand with Latin American police and military forces, whose death squads and torturers are supervised by agents of the DEA. The infiltration of the DEA and the variety of political assignments for its agents have caused such violent splits within the Bureau that one can speak of two wings which fight one another. One wing carries out guns for drugs and protection programs, the other tries desperately to combat the drug traffic carried out or protected by the first. Among the expressions of this bitter internal strife, apparently, are the Cecilia Falcone and Werbel cases and the dismissal of DEA Director Bartels for suspected corruption. Recently, the use of drug profits to finance right-wing terrorism has been placed in a new perspective by revelations of Cuban exile teamwork with European and Latin American fascists and the economic support of the World Anti-Communist League for the same anti-communist groups. And that brings us to the final link in the chain of drugs, intelligence, and fascism. And I would emphasize that our next Radio Free America show is going to cover that final link. And the next link, we're going to talk not only about Klaus Barbie and the cocaine situation, but about this final intersection, the final link, as Kruger puts it, in the chain of drugs, intelligence, and fascism. Let me add that broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills, we're not going to go to that last section, that this next topic, in tonight's broadcast. We're going to read a little bit more about the actual results of Kruger's thesis here, the great heroin coup, the use of former CIA agents in the DEA not to eliminate the heroin traffic, but to corner it for Nixon's intelligence and organized crime allies. We're going to look at the results of the heroin coup in terms of the actual heroin traffic itself, because the actual subject of the use of the DEA and narcotics trafficking for right-wing terror is going to occupy the bulk of our next broadcast. We should actually have some time for some phone calls here, maybe after a telephone break, but we're going to continue with some more information here.
All right, reading a little bit more from the Great Heroin Coup. From 1975 until the end of 1978, the DEA consistently maintained that between 80 and 90% of the heroin consumed in the United States was Mexican. However, the claim doesn't stand up against the following facts. 1. 80% of the world's heroin, exactly the figure exported from Marseille until 1972, was, at least until late 1976, produced from opium harvested in the Golden Triangle and distributed via Bangkok, Singapore, and Hong Kong. 2. The number of arrests of couriers en route from Southeast Asia increased steadily after 1973. 3. Reports from New York and other big cities testified to the arrival of large shipments of white heroin from Southeast Asia. 4. The market supply of heroin did not dwindle despite aerial destruction of an estimated 60% of Mexico's poppy fields in early 1976. 5. An effective tidal wave of Golden Triangle heroin began flooding Europe in 1973, while many couriers en route to the U.S. and Canada were nabbed by European police. 6. The DEA was aware of Santo Traficante's dealings in Southeast Asia, as well as the later Mafia summit in Palermo, where large sums of money were set aside for investment in the Golden Triangle. 7. It was easy to verify the narcotics flow from Mexico, since the border was subject to close surveillance. But to conclude that most of the heroin on the U.S. market originated in Mexico was a stretch of logic. Even the DEA had to admit the tenuousness of its claims. On February 24, 1976, the DEA's John Cusack, C-U-S-A-C-K, admitted that his agency's estimate that only 8% of U.S. heroin came from Southeast Asia was surprising, considering the region's prolific opium production. He added, quote, "We are also concerned about our detection during 1975 of substantial quantities of white number 4 heroin moving directly from Bangkok to the United States. In December, for example, 46 kilograms of heroin were seized in Bangkok, concealed in the household effects shipment of a returning U.S. serviceman. Follow-up investigation and the development of an extensive conspiracy prosecution has identified 12 additional shipments entering the United States since 1974. Unquote. 12 such shipments meant 552 kilos, or more than the entire 472 kilos confiscated in the U.S. in 1975, and from only one of many Southeast Asian smuggling networks. Cusack went even further. Quote, "It appears almost certain that the bulk of the white heroin found during 1975 in the inner city areas of our eastern cities has been Asian number 4, smuggled from Bangkok."
Why then did the DEA continue to overstate Mexico's role and minimize Southeast Asia, even after the publication in 1972 of Alfred McCoy's The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia? perhaps to justify the great expenditure in support of right-wing military and police forces in Latin America. The later boom in Colombian cocaine would also provide justification. Southeast Asia was downplayed so as not to jeopardize relations with America's loyal, if corrupt, allies, most of all Thailand, Taiwan, and the latter's overseas agents. They were allowed to profit from opium and heroin in relative peace. Another reason. The DEA could not expose the Southeast Asia connection without compromising the CIA. A secret 1977 House Government Operations Subcommittee report accused the CIA of helping an Asian opium ring smuggle drugs into the United States and then lying about it to Congress. Puttaporn Kramkruan, P-U-T-T-A-P-O-R-N, K-H-R-A-M-K-H-R-U-A-N, a Thai national, was arrested in 1973 for smuggling 59 pounds of pure opium into the U.S. via JFK Airport. Citing national security interests, the agency had the case squelched, and Kramkruan was sent back home. However, the House Committee eventually established that he was a CIA operative in Thailand. In fact, he was on the payroll of a CIA proprietary using the Agency for International Development, AID, as a cover for training the corrupt Thai border police. Furthermore, Kramkruan told a DEA investigator that he had been an officer in the Kuomintang Army and guarded opium mule caravans. His CIA contact was the U.S. consul in Chiang Mai, Thailand. In its report, the House Committee stated, quote, "It was ironic that the CIA should be given the responsibility of narcotics intelligence, particularly since they are supporting the prime movers," unquote. I'm going to read that last sentence again, quoting from a House Committee report. "It was ironic that the CIA should be given the responsibility of narcotics intelligence, particularly since they are supporting the prime movers." In March 1977, the DEA began to speak of major maneuvers in the international Asian narcotics market for a share of the U.S. drug scene, unquote, and of a coalition between the U.S. Mafia, the Corsicans, and the Chu Chow Chinese triad, unquote. The coalition had, in reality, existed at least since 1970, and perhaps as early as Traficante's 1968 journey to the East, and it had functioned effectively, shipping large amounts of heroin to the U.S. since 1972 and 3. The difference was that the Corsican arm of the coalition, their own umbrella organization having been smashed, was now essentially reduced to some 100 men working with the U.S. Mafia and the Chinese, most of them as chemists in Thailand's mobile heroin labs. Who has controlled the Golden Triangle opium traffic and heroin production since the establishment of the Mafia-Chinese coalition, besides the CIA, that is? The answer is the Kuomintang, KMT, the Kuomintang Chinese and overseas Chu Chow Syndicate, men such as Chang Chi-Fu, Lo Sing-Han, Tsai Chen-Cheng, and older, more familiar figures like General Lai Mi. Still head of what's left of the Kuomintang forces, General Lee resides in luxury outside Chiang Mai and received official visits there from the United States as recently as late 1976. In 1976 and 7, a minor war was about to erupt over the control of the region's opium traffic and mobile refineries. Potential combatants were Chu Chi-Fu's United Shan Army of rebels against the Burmese regime and Kuomintang forces under General Lee. However, the opposing leaders were brought together by a senior Thai officer, and an agreement was reached on the marketing of drugs and supply of arms to fight communist forces in Burma's Shan states. Again, we see the connection between narcotics and anti-communist paramilitary operations, albeit Chu Chi-Fu later pulled out of the agreement, was arrested in Thailand, and eventually extradited to Burma. The DEA's Golden Triangle Unit, SNO, made many whole and half-hearted attempts to eradicate the narcotics plague. All failed. Production has been great, the world's heroin market having multiplied in the 70s. SNA won't say outright that the CIA is undermining them, nor that politics underlies their constant failures. An SNO agent, nevertheless, came close to doing this in his 1976 statement to Alfred McCoy, quote, "If they were selling shares in Golden Triangle Heroin Incorporated in 5, 10, and 20-year bonds, I would put my money on a 20-year bond. The only thing that would end the whole Golden Triangle business would be a communist takeover in Thailand. If that happened, I'd sell my stock," unquote. Here again, the point being that The great heroin coup not only shifted the control of the heroin traffic from the Corsican syndicate to their Sicilian and Cuban and CIA competitors, but beyond that, the main focus of the heroin traffic was not Mexico, as was being bandied about, by the DEA, but rather Southeast Asia. And I think it's worth bearing in mind Kruger's, not only his analysis of the possible role of the Galen World Anti-Communist League organization in this narcotics traffic and the use of parallel police for anti-communist terror, read anti-democratic terror, because according to WACL and CIA elements, basically a communist is anyone who doesn't believe in fascism, and that's, I think, that there are an awful lot of graves marked and unmarked all around the world that would testify to that. The graves of priests, school teachers, and all kinds of other people who were not communists, but were not fascists either, and paid dearly for that philosophy. I think it's worth considering the tremendous amount of press being given to Mexico as a center of corruption and drug traffic to this day, and whether or not the attention being focused on Mexico again serves to provide the pretext for the use of Mexico, of the DEA and other organizations for the use of intelligence and, quote, anti-communist, read fascist operations.
Indeed, and also, as we were talking about at the beginning of the broadcast, many of the current things going on in terms of not just the Iran and Nicaraguan scandal story coming out, but a lot of the current administration policy has begun to come back in bits and pieces as being tied into the narcotics trade. Of course, we have become massive suppliers in the past 7-8 years now of the Afghan guerrillas, the Mujahideen, through Pakistan. Of course, this is one of the reasons that General Zia-ul-Haq is still in charge in Pakistan. The man is it's a military government. It's practically martial law in Pakistan. Zia-ul-Haq, of course, is our man there, and we are using Pakistan as our conduit for weapons to the Mujahideen guerrillas. But on the flip side, recently, packages of hashish have been showing up in the United States with the Mujahideen slogans and propaganda on them. Buy a gram of hash, kill a Russian, et cetera, that sort of thing. That's just one example. Of course, we talked at great length about what's going on with Nicaragua. Now, interestingly enough, at the time that, now remember George Bush, our current vice president, and remember, too, also, this is a rather interesting parallel, because of Richard Nixon, as vice president, sort of putting together his connections to the drug trade and these other various trades and the intelligence apparatus and all these things, preparatory to becoming president, as he felt he would in 1960, and setting up things like the Bay of Pigs operation, again, thinking that he was going to be the president in 1960. Bear that in mind with George Bush, who, of course, is the heir apparent. George Bush himself also naturally a former DCIA, director of the CIA, during the time a lot of this stuff was being consolidated in 1975 and 1976, and a lot of the connections between the CIA and the Latin American death squads were becoming institutionalized. More recently, as vice president, George Bush was down in Florida as head of a DEA task force that was supposedly going to put the blocks to the drug traffic once and for all. Well, leaving the obvious absurdity of that aside, since as we've talked about at great length and we'll talk at even greater length during the next Radio Free America, the cocaine trade is largely a creature of the right wing, the American right wing and the Latin American right wing, with some help from the European right wing. But leaving the absurdity of George Bush's claim that he's stamping it out aside, one of those very self-same former CIA agents who we talked about at great length, Frank Turple, suggested that, in fact, George Bush's whole DEA operation in Florida was just a further excuse to inject the CIA, to use the DEA as a form of hypodermic, which is, in fact, what Henrik Kruger is talking about, using the DEA as a form of hypodermic to inject the CIA covertly into further areas of Latin American politics. Now, besides the great heroin coup, which is probably the best source for the stuff we're talking about tonight, which is why we use it at such great length, the cited book, Alfred McCoy's Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, lays out a lot of the ground we've talked about in earlier broadcasts. There's some rather interesting things that crop up in some other books as well. I'm going to recommend one or two, and I think Dave's got some to recommend. One of them is a book called Hidden Terrors by A.J. Langeth, which goes in some length about the AID connections, the Aid for International Development, They were talking in the Great Heroin Coup. Kruger was talking about police officers who are trained in these terror factories, essentially in the United States, and sent back down to Latin America, oftentimes with CIA and DEA oversight, trained in basically repressive measures, torture and assassination. And Hidden Terrorists by A.J. Langeth, formerly a writer, I believe, for the New York Times, is a book entirely about the death of Dan Mitrione, an American police chief who, with connections to the CIA, who was in fact just that kind of American operative in Latin America, Uruguay and Brazil, among others. There are a variety of other books. Spooks by James Hogan. James Hogan was quoted during this book, is one that you might also want to check out.
There are a couple of other books. I would like to emphasize, though, that the material here is probably the best, we'll go into those perhaps in a second, the best single analysis of the interrelationship between, as Kruger puts it, drugs, intelligence, and international fascism ever done. And again, the use of the DEA not only to corner the narcotics traffic, but in turn as a vehicle of the U.S. intelligence apparatus and as a major adjunct to the Latin American terror campaigns shouldn't be overlooked. We will. We're kicking around the possibility. Obviously, it'll have to be cleared with programming of perhaps in May, during KFJC's Month of Mayhem, when we do particular special programming, maybe doing a two-part series on Iranagua or Irangate, Contragate, where we will review not only the anti-Castro Cubans, many of the same elements involved in the Coru-Bosch terror campaign, their involvement in this whole situation, and the role of narcotics and the narcotics traffic in the system that we're seeing down that's exploding right now on the U.S. scene, and in terms of the Iran-Contragate scandal. In our next broadcast, we will be talking about the cocaine trade and taking Kruger's next step, the development of the narcotics traffic as a major source of quote, anti-communist terror, and again, the working definition of a communist being anybody who opposes fascism. And I think the activities, for example, in places like Guatemala, El Salvador, and Argentina will bear very eloquent, if perhaps silent, witness to that situation. Archbishop Romero in El Salvador was not exactly a flaming communist, and yet he was assassinated by these, quote, anti-communist death squads. I think that's a good example. We will be talking about that not only in our next broadcast, but like I said, possibly in May, we're going to take up the Iran-Contragate scandal in maybe a two-part archive series. We would like to let it percolate for a little while, because obviously there's more information coming out. We were going to do one after our second program, but so much has come out since that we're both pretty glad that we did not leap ahead, since any archive show that we would have done at that time would be awfully incomplete compared to what we have coming out. At the same time, we don't want to let it develop like we did the Pope shooting, because we don't have to do five-hour things, you know, in a future day. I'll say that for sure. But going back to some good books to read on the subject, there's an excellent book called Of Grass and Snow by Hank Messick, the author of Lansky, one of the definitive works on Meyer Lansky, a key player in the Nixon White House and in this whole great heroin coup scenario proposed by Henrik Kruger. Also an excellent book called The Heroin Trail by the authors of Newsday. Also the aforementioned Peroff by L.H. Whittemore, talking about the suppression of the Robert Vesco connection. I think it's worth mentioning, too, that Robert Vesco has been mentioned as being among the people who was involved with alleged Sandinista drug trafficking and alleged Castro-Cuban drug trafficking, whereas, as we've seen, Robert Vesco's affiliations are primarily on the other side of the fence, and indeed, the alleged Sandinista drug smuggling has now appeared to be not only not Sandinista, but indeed contra-drug smuggling, with the case of Adler Barry Seal, something we will be taking up when we go into Iran-Contragate. So, again, there's a lot of information that we've presented this evening. What we're going to do now is take a musical break. We haven't got a phone screener with us, but if people would like to phone in and discuss some of the information we've talked about, we do have almost 45 minutes until 11 o'clock. You should treasure the opportunity. We seldom have phone calls in one of our archive shows, but this is sort of the end of one major phase of what we've been talking about, and rather than take up what is really the subject of an entire next archive show, our fourth in this series, and we got at least one more to talk about how the CIA unloaded the psychedelic era, quote-unquote, on people, we thought rather than sort of open another whole door, we'd sort of seal off the entity here. But the phone number up here is area code 415-941-2500. What we'll do is we'll take three calls, you know, clear screen three calls, and then go and take the calls, and then if we, you know, depending on how fast they go, put on some more music, screen three more calls, and so forth. So if people would like to call in at this point, we have almost 45 minutes.
That's right. Now, there's always the possibilities that everybody has their tapes on, and they're not going to find out that we're calling for phone calls until they put the tape on tomorrow. But we will take a musical break, and if you are out there and you would like to talk about some of this stuff, as Dave mentioned, I think it's been about 12 or 13 or maybe...